But that the resolution of my friend had been inspired by faith and prayer, that deserves some reflection. There is, in fact, an obligation to be competent. Many Christians forget it, imagining probably that devotion is all that is needed. Mr. P. Chanson has painted us a graphic portrait of such a person. Here is a Christian businessman, who, to his credit, has become devout. He grows jealous of his time for meditation, his job becomes a burden. And why worry about money anyway? He is intelligent, well-liked and a good speaker. He is urged to accept the presidency of his corporation. Good heavens, no, that would be an occasion of pride. He has read and reread that 5 minutes of prayer each day are worth more than 20 years of active life. Now, thanks to his judicious employment of time, it is an hour, tomorrow two or three perhaps, which he will consecrate to prayer. Except for the habit, he is a monk. Why should he compromise his spirituality in the hullabaloo of public assemblies? His wife and children already take enough time away from his meditation. Ah, if he were alone in the world, he would be content with next to nothing. It is just such errors as these which make all proposals and exercises of spirituality suspect. To speak to lay people of the interior life and union with God is, it is thought, to encourage them to disregard their responsibilities and to evade their family, professional or apostolic duties. Is someone who is preoccupied with God apt to concern himself with the things of the earth? Such objectors do not understand that the spiritual life of the layman does not consist in playing the monk, but in living the life of charity proper to his own state of life. This charity imposes a duty to consecrate oneself to those tasks with an ever-increasing competence, a competence which is itself a form of charity. To be competent is, in fact, to love one's brothers. One who applies his intelligence and strength to discovering the secrets of nature, or to elaborating better laws for the city, or he who becomes capable of helping the suffering, or diminishing the pain of men, does he not practice fraternal love in a preeminent way? To be competent is also to love God. He who loves God the most is not he who cries Lord, Lord, but he who does his will and collaborates in his work. For God has done men the honor of willing to need their assistance. The earth will not bear its harvest without the labor of man, the child will not become an adult without education. But without competence, workers and parents are poor collaborators. To love the Lord is to bear witness to Him. The competent Christian is, in certain areas, the only witness whose testimony is accepted. Often where sermons are not listened to, where grace is not understood, competence wins respect. When a social worker, a farmer or a professor are competent, those who work with them, won by the prestige of that competence, are drawn to the man, and sometimes even to the God present in his heart. There is often astonishment. Christians do not seek only heaven. They are also fired by social problems, by art, by science. Can it be that the God of the Christians is truly interested in our planet, in our little human histories? The apologetic of competence, especially paired with the apologetic of devotion, can succeed where others fail. A duty greater than that of loving. When you were engaged or first married, you young wives surely asked yourselves, "Will I be able to make him happy?" And then that other question, a sign of greater maturity, "Will I be able to help this man to realize himself, to become always better?" What has become of that man today, because of you? Do you strive, day after day, to help him attain his full stature? Saint-Exupéry has given us, in Night Flight, a portrait of Rivière, who was a pioneer of night flying, and organizer of regular flights between Europe and America. A bold innovator, energetic and tenacious. He was very hard on his pilots, not through lack of love, but in order to obey what he called a duty greater than that of loving. To speak exactly, this greater duty is still one of love, but of a greater love. There is nothing beyond love, but there are many ways of loving. And the hardness of Rivière was one of the most effective, Out of an adolescent he made a man. Out of a new employee he made a knight of the skies. By making them risk their lives, he saved those lives. Do you wives obey this duty greater than that of loving? Do you work for the greatness of your husband as well as his happiness? And can you prefer his greatness to his happiness when, in order to obtain the former, the latter must be sacrificed? I am not speaking, of course, of that essential happiness which lies in the depths of the upright soul, and which is not opposed to greatness, but of that easy happiness found in the enjoyment of the goods of the earth and the richness of the spirit. But what is true greatness? That man alone is great who is fully aware of his responsibilities and assumes them unhesitatingly. Watch your children grow. Isn't it true that their progress is measured by their ascending the scale of responsibilities? You have charge of them when they are very small, but only for a short while. They soon want to fly on their own, they want to feed themselves, to walk down the street alone. They are becoming responsible for their bodily life, and soon of their souls, helped by you. They learn that there are some acts which harm them and others which ennoble them. The years pass, and one day you can read the pride on the face of your son, to whom has been entrusted some task in man's world, a piece of ground to plant, a tractor to drive. A little later and he is a husband, responsible for the woman who has believed in him, then a father, with a joy at once exultant and solemn in his heart. Shall he stop there? No. The man who knows only his home and works only for his own has not yet attained his true stature. He lacks the awareness and the acceptance of his responsibility for the human community, and, if he is a Christian, for the salvation of his brothers, and of the whole church. Maybe you think that I am an accomplice to that temptation of evasion, to which so many husbands, only too happy to avoid the thousand cares and problems of the home, quickly succumb, as soon as a good pretext arises. Maybe you accuse me of ignoring the fact that in every man there long remains the adolescent love of action for its own sake, and the enthusiasm for adventure. Not at all. Indeed, it seems to be desirable at the beginning of married life that husband and wife concentrate on building their home life, rather than engaging in outside activities. But while it is true that they must never abandon this effort, the time comes when the husband, having solidly founded his family, must no longer hesitate to assume social responsibilities. To avoid them would be betrayal. Understand, I ask that he assume these responsibilities efficaciously. I have no intention of justifying those men who feel a silly pride in belonging to 36 committees, or who imagine that they will reform the planet by their interminable and sterile conferences. They would be doing something far more useful if they stayed home and spanked their children. Without the help of a woman, a man rarely comes to moral adulthood, as we have just defined it. This is why, when I consider so many fine men whom I know, I cannot help thinking that their wives are not up to their mission. I'm not generalizing. I can easily imagine the secret sorrow of many good women whose husbands remain careless and egotistical all their lives. But how many others are there, whose love is a snare for the man, when it should inspire and stimulate him to action? I say love, I ought to say egoism in this case. For egoism is not a masculine privilege. There is a feminine egoism too, which for all its difference, is no less baneful. Composed of selfishness, domination and jealousy. Men's lives by the hundred are rendered fruitless by it. It is not always egoism, strictly speaking, which plays this role, but often merely an insufficient love. It is touching to see this father play with his children every evening, it is good to see him happy in his home. Ought he really to be encouraged to enter into political battles? Or into Catholic action which will take so much of his time. Here indeed, for the wife, is that duty greater than that of loving. But heroism is necessary for it, and heroic women are few. As a result, their husbands are only good boys all their lives. If your husband is passionately concerned with great causes today, if every injustice finds him indignant and ready for action, if he does not hesitate to commit himself at a time when slackers crawl back to their holes, if the thought of the millions who do not know Christ is like a thorn in his heart, let me reassure you. When a man can write, as the one who had escaped from a concentration camp wrote me, "It is not in spite of my family duties, but precisely because I am a father, that I am in the fight," then I see at his side the presence of a deeply spiritual wife who understands and encourages him, and I give thanks for a victory of love. If, on the other hand, you feel obliged to agree that your love has thus far been inferior to its task, meditate on these remarks of Dr. or Juliet, and I hope they will help you to make the appropriate resolutions. Will the fear of losing their Christian sense of values continue to keep Christians out of public life? Will the counsel given them, for example, always to put their marital life first and to foster day by day the life of the home and the family, make them hesitate? The strength of the communists comes from the fact that they do not hesitate to sacrifice their family life for the sake of the cause. Among Christians, the family is not always a radiating center. It is sometimes a barrier to the gift of self, and sometimes extinguishes any apostolic zeal. The crucial question is whether Christians must not sacrifice certain family joys and pleasures for the sake of serving the city, and compensate for these renunciations by a greater effort of understanding and family intimacy, with the hope that our Lord will, by an increase of grace, make up for the hours or days taken from the life of the home. You may think that in writing these things, I have been unfaithful to the ideal of Christian marriage. If so, you have either misunderstood me, or you do not understand what the phrase marital and family spirituality means. I have no desire to promote a return to an isolationist spirituality, the wife on one side, tied to the home and the children, the husband on the other, concerned only with activities outside the home. The true order consists in this: a head of the family who takes charge in the fullest sense of the home, a wife who, without herself failing to respond to the appeals of the city and the church, encourages her husband to assume his responsibilities, and helps him to bear them. But this is possible only where a deep mutual love exists and that common seeking of the Lord which the Christian ideal of marriage ceaselessly urges upon us. For the more love grows, the more it becomes impatient to serve. The risk is not one of loving too much, but of loving badly. Nor is it a matter of being too preoccupied with one's spiritual life. The more the husband and wife progress in the knowledge of Christ, the more they understand the meaning of his words, addressed as much to homes as to individuals: "He who would save his life will lose it, he who loses his life will save it." The lack of anxiety. You who are so tranquil in your possession of truth, so comfortably established on the first rung of the virtuous life, your lack of anxiety makes me uneasy. But why should we be anxious? You say. Even if we are not perfect, at least we try to keep the moral law and to do good around us. That's not good enough. Morality is more than that. For morality is not only avoiding evil, or merely doing something, but of doing good, the whole good. As long as there is dissension in the world, and as long as there is a man who suffers, or there is something better to be done, you are not following the law, for each man is responsible for the world. Moreover, you only have to read the Bible, that disquieting little book, to convince yourself of it. The whole moral law of Christ can be summed up in three words: do you love? But love is unlimited. No one can boast of being in perfect accord with it. The measure of love is to love without measure. Love is life, and the biologist tells us, life is tension, movement, ingenuity, tenacity, and irrepressible striving. All that is contrary to quietude. There is no rest for him who loves. That is why there are so many who seek to hide from love, who fear it and prefer to submit to some code. But you must understand what love is. To love is to wish the growth of a person, it is to work furiously to that end. It is to give all that you have and all that you are. It is to suffer not having riches enough to fill him up without measure.